they can start treating their people like human beings with dignity.
New sanctions against North Korea. We have an exclusive with a top U.S. official. It's Friday, January 13th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You're also a part of the program. Join us now on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China, Taiwan, and U.S. relations. Chinese CEOs have different ideas of business under President Trump. Cambodians start small U.S. businesses. Korean American Day art. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The U.S. Treasury Department has added 7 North Koreans and 2 North Korean government entities to its sanctions list. Reports of systematic government-sanctioned human rights abuses, including forced labor, led to the additional sanctions. And just after the announcement late yesterday, VOA Korean reporter Ji-Un spoke with Tom Malinowski, Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, about details of the latest sanctions.
Well, I think it shows that we remain committed to identifying those members of the North Korean leadership and security apparatus who are responsible for the worst human rights abuses that happen in that country, and to holding them accountable. Mm-hmm. And I think that process, which is part of our law in the United States now, will continue, and I hope that it sends a message to everybody in the North Korean government that there is a long-term price to be paid for being involved in things like management of the labor camps or censorship or the persecution of dissidents who have fled the country.
Mm-hmm. Following the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, this time around his younger sister Kim Yo-jong was also included. What was behind this decision?
She is responsible for a branch of the North Korean government that engages in propaganda and censorship, the massive system of information control that exists in the country, the system of deification and worship of the leadership. And so we're not naming her because she's somebody's sister. We're naming her because of the personal role that she has played.
Will there be a series of more human rights sanctions against North Korea?
It's a regular process. Mm-hmm. It is done now in accordance with a law that our Congress has passed, so that remains in place, even though there is a change in administrations here in Washington. And I think there's bipartisan support for this policy. Republicans, Democrats support it, and I imagine that there will be subsequent lists.
Mm-hmm. What is your advice to the Trump administration?
My advice is that any long-term solution to the security issues that have troubled us coming from North Korea for many, many years is not likely to come until the North Korean people have the power to shape the future of their country. And in that respect, the human rights policy, although it's the right thing to do in and of itself, reinforces the larger strategy that I hope the next administration will continue to pursue.
Mm-hmm. What is your message to the North Korean government?
Well, they can stop putting people in concentration camps who disagree with them. They can stop executing people who the dear leader of the country is angry at. They can start treating their people like human beings with dignity. I'm afraid that the government of North Korea probably fears that if they actually did any of those things, their people might wonder, well, why are we ruled by one family for decade after decade, and why is the Korean Peninsula divided into two countries? That's probably what they're afraid of, that if they were to give their people the ability to decide for themselves, they would make decisions that are not favorable to the Kim family and to the current regime. But that is what they owe their people, and that's what we will not rest until we see happens.
I see. Just one last question. A very high-level diplomat, Tae Yong-ho, just recently defected to South Korea. Do you see any signs of change within the North Korean government with the influx of information from outside?
Well, the big change is what you just mentioned. It's the influx of information, and people from regular people living in the provinces to the elites living in Pyongyang, they know much more now about the outside world. They know that their country is not normal. They know that people in South Korea live with much greater wealth, much greater freedom, and much greater security than they do. And I think over time that is bound to have an impact on the thinking of people up and down the chain in North Korea. And we can't predict when that will start leading to political changes. But I think we can say that the political changes that will eventually come will have their roots, will have their origins in this this breaking down of the information controls, which we are encouraging as much as we can.
Tom Malinowski, Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, speaking with VOA Korean reporter Ji Eun. You can see the entire video on our VOA Asia Facebook page. These are among the top stories that are trending in Asia on voanews.com. North Korea's nuclear threat seen as attention-grabbing stunt. Former UN Secretary General pivots towards South Korean presidential bid. Japan's Abe starts four-nation trip with visit to Philippines. Donald Trump urged to make North Korean human rights a priority. Philippines to offer free contraceptives to poor. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on Facebook at VOA Asia and also on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen stopped over in Houston, Texas on her way to Central America this week, and during her brief stay in the Lone Star State, she met with United States Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Governor Greg Abbott. What's the significance of the meeting, and how might this play out on the global stage? VOA's Steve Miller reports.
Following the 2016 presidential election, President-elect Donald Trump took a call from Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen and questioned whether the United States should continue following the policy laid out in 1979, recognizing the Communist-led People's Republic of China as the sole government of China, or One China. This week, when Tsai was traveling to Central America, she had a brief stopover in Houston, Texas. There, she met with Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Governor Greg Abbott. John Minnick, senior East Asia analyst with intelligence firm Stratfor, says on Skype that the significance isn't in the meeting itself, but
there is a significance that lays in the broader context of the visit. And it takes place against a backdrop of real flux in cross-strait relations and U.S.-Taiwan relations. I mean, this is a moment of incredible uncertainty as to what's going to happen.
Minnick says that Tsai is essentially caught in the middle as the United States and China are rethinking their relationships. However, speaking via Skype, Harry Kazianis, the director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest, called the meeting
extremely significant because they're trying to reach out beyond the Trump camp and to reach out to other mainstream Republicans to try and build these connections and to build these linkages.
And while in the here and now, attention is focused on the Tsai-Cruz-Abbott meeting in Texas, Minnick points out that last year, Tsai met Senator Marco Rubio in Florida, so this type of meeting isn't the first of its kind. Kazianis also emphasized its low-key nature and how Taiwan doesn't necessarily want to upset the status quo. But as Minnick points out,
on the most fundamental level, Taiwan's sovereignty is an issue of other countries. And with that in mind, Taiwan's in a very precarious situation right now because China has been very adamant, very steadfast in working to further isolate Taiwan diplomatically.
So why take a meeting with Tsai? Harry Kazianis.
I think Senator Cruz is very clear that he's very interested in Asia policy. He's very interested also in trying to build ties with Taiwan for his state.
Noting that there's a significant trade relationship between the U.S. and Taiwan.
So we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of bilateral trade. And I think that's very important for the individual states to try and work with Taiwan. And for Taiwan, it's very important. It's difficult for them to increase the bilateral relationship as much as they want with the United States. But the individual states can do that very reasonably and very effectively.
China has established the adherence of the One China policy as the basis for continued relations with Beijing. And because it has a robust military and is the second largest world economy with global ties, Kaziana suggests,
no country is going to change the One China policies. However, there's a lot of room for maneuver just below that threshold.
If a country does decide to break with that, Minnick says China would respond
through diplomatic isolation, military intimidation of Taiwan to compel Taiwan to back off, but also do what it can through economic coercion to affect that country.
Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, Rex Tillerson, President-elect Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, called China's actions in the South China Sea Wednesday an illegal taking of disputed areas without regard for international norms. Tillerson also said the United States should take a harder line against Beijing and restrict access to its islands there. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy to have you with us on VOA Asia. China's top corporate executives are divided about how to handle investments in the United States under the new Trump administration. Saibal Dasgupta is in China. He's followed these developments and joins us by phone from Beijing. Saibal, let's talk about three of the biggest CEOs in China who have spoken about doing business with the United States.
You can start with Wang Jianlin. He's the richest man in China. He's close to the government, and he's the owner of the largest theater chain in the U.S. He started out by saying that if Trump is really going to take punitive action against Chinese or Chinese business, then I'm going to pull out my $10 billion of investment, and there will be workers who will go without food. That's exactly what he said. So the whole idea of retaliation, the Chinese retaliation to anything Trump might do, which was being advocated by the state media very loudly, was now voiced by a CEO, a very important CEO who is supposed to be close to the government.
There's also the Chinese auto glass tycoon who has taken a bit of a different view.
Yes. Suddenly he comes out with this statement saying that he's going to actually invest and create more jobs in the U.S. Why did you have to talk about creating jobs? One can, it's okay for a CEO to talk about investing in the U.S. Why does he want to go and invest in the U.S. Midwest? What happened in the social media that he was dubbed a traitor, and there's a huge, huge campaign against it.
Well, most folks in the United States by now have become a little bit familiar with Jack Ma, who is the CEO of Alibaba, the Chinese version of Amazon, if you will. And he was actually here in the United States this past week meeting with Donald Trump in New York. An interesting offer from Jack Ma.
That was really the third surprise. Why would Trump want to meet Jack Ma in the first place? And then why would Jack Ma go and make this big offer? Now, we have to understand just that just 3 weeks back, the U.S. Trade Office issued an order declaring Jack Ma's online shopping site, Taobao, as a notorious marketplace and blacklisting it for selling counterfeit goods. So he obviously wants it revoked by the new president, and he really wants to enter the U.S. market in a very big way. There is no question about that, because if he can really defeat Amazon, then he would have made it the biggest retailer in the world and the most powerful. And he would also sort of be highly esteemed by the Chinese government if he can manage to do it, because he represents Chinese business might, so to say.
Saibal Dasgupta reports for VOA from Beijing. Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Thanks a lot, Jim.
This is VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's first stop in a regional four-nation trip was the Philippines. He hopes to work with Philippines President Duterte on countering illegal drugs and the social cost of drug addiction. Abe is the first foreign leader to visit the Philippines since Duterte became president. You'll find more with Steve Miller's Asia Minute every weekday on Facebook at VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. The discussion of incoming President Donald Trump being business-friendly has been good news for small businesses in the United States, which impact the economy and employment just as much as large companies. For Cambodian immigrants, many have found the southern state of Georgia the perfect place to start and grow their own businesses, as we hear from VOA Khmer correspondent Men Kim Sing.
This Cambodian-owned nail salon on the outskirts of Atlanta, Georgia, is almost full by noon on a Sunday. Since early morning, workers are busy polishing and painting nails for their clients at tables and large chairs. This is a popular job among Cambodians living in the U.S. Kung Chan Sukun has been running the business for 9 years and has employed 15 staff. He explained that many Cambodians who have migrated to the United States do not have the qualifications to be a doctor or a lawyer or running a big business, and instead they have to do blue-collar work.
There is no way to earn a living other than doing this nail salon job. The reality is that we don't have high knowledge, and this job does not require much knowledge.
Chan Sukun is among a new generation of Cambodian Americans who have started their own small business instead of seeking employment with others. Another small business owner, Winnie Chai, has run an auto shop since 2006. Chai was a high school soccer player but decided not to pursue a career in sports after graduation.
Should I work for others? No, I don't want to work for others.
Tony Om shares similar thoughts. He has owned a truck business for 12 years now.
In Georgia, some Cambodians began to start up their own businesses. In the past, many of them simply drove trucks for companies.
Tony has had many jobs, from a job in a restaurant to driving a truck for an American shipping company before saving up enough money to start his own business. He advised other Cambodians follow suit to take the chance.
My belief is that if we worked for others, we can just survive from one paycheck to another. We are living a simple life like others, which means we have a car and enough meals, but we cannot be rich. If we want to be rich with a brighter future and get things as we want, like big houses, we have to start a business.
There are over 10,000 Cambodian Americans living in Georgia, and most of them live in Atlanta's southern Riverdale City in Clayton County. Kim Seung-man, VOA Khmer, reporting from Riverdale, Georgia.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Developing at this hour in Asia, Amnesty International says human rights in Hong Kong are at their lowest point since the 1997 handover to Chinese rule. The report questioned if the physical safety of citizens was guaranteed after five Hong Kong booksellers were detained in China. VOA Asia keeps you informed all day on Facebook. Now on VOA Asia, new art is on display here in Washington to celebrate Korean American Day today. VOA Asia's Steve Miller took his camera to have a look at the Korean Cultural Center, which is located in the Korean Embassy, and he spoke with Ji Young-yoon, curator of exhibition and design.
It's work by Korean-American artists, and actually this is our largest exhibition ever. So we have 30 Korean-American artists who express their spiritual and inner movement inspired by nature and their life.
Are the artists local to the area, or are they from all over the United States?
No, actually, they are from Washington, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland.
How long will the works be on display?
The exhibition remains until January 22nd, 2017.
How did the Cultural Center reach out to the artists and invite them into this space?
This is kind of a special exhibition prepared by Korean Cultural Center to celebrate Korean American Days on January 13th. So we would like to, you know, show the appreciation to the Korean American artists who has been, you know, showing their passion and their creativity in this area.
And we should say that the Hanmi Association are the group of artists that have all the work on display here.
Yes. Hanmi Artists Association of Greater Washington is founded in 1975 by a few Korean American artists in Virginia area. This is their 42nd anniversary.
And be sure to see what Steve Miller saw. His video is on our VOA Asia Facebook page. A big hello to our listeners in Myanmar enjoying our program on VOA Burma Facebook. Thank you so much. Also like us on our Facebook page, VOA Asia. Our thanks, too, to Director Tracy Carter, Carl Starling, our engineer, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns in the strongest possible terms the recent horrific vehicular attack by a terrorist in Jerusalem. 4 soldiers were killed, including 1 U.S. citizen, and 17 wounded when a flatbed truck driven by an Arab terrorist rammed into a group of soldiers adjacent to the Arman Hanatziv Promenade in southeastern Jerusalem on January 8th. 3 female soldiers and 1 male soldier were declared dead at the scene. According to the Israeli Defense Forces, an additional 2 cadets were seriously wounded, and 15 other officers and cadets sustained less severe wounds. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who visited the scene with Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman shortly after the attack, said the identity of the terrorist was known. Later, he was identified as Fadi al-Qanbar from a nearby Jerusalem neighborhood. "We are fighting this plague and will defeat it. We will overcome this terrorism just as we overcame other attacks," said Prime Minister Netanyahu. Speaking to reporters following the attack, Jerusalem Mayor Nir Barkat said, "To our dismay, there is no limit to the cruelty of the terrorists, who are willing to use any means possible to murder Jews and to damage the routine of life in Israel's capital. There is absolutely no justification for these brutal and senseless attacks," said U.S. Deputy State Department spokesperson Mark Toner. "We condemn the glorification of terrorism now or at any time, and call on all to send a clear message that terrorism must never be tolerated. Our thoughts and prayers are with the families of the 4 Israeli soldiers who were killed."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.